Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. We're well and truly back in the saddle now. The wind is in our sails and the engines are running. To completely mangle the sporting metaphors to get this week's podcast kicked off. Basically, football has started again. That's kind of all I really wanted to say. We had a good win on Monday night. Midweek games didn't quite go as well as we might have liked, apart from, of course, Manchester United getting beaten by Wolves. But Chelsea won and Tottenham won, and we're now sitting at the time of recording in fourth place. Tottenham have gone ahead of us, playing at their new stadium. Apparently they've got a new stadium. Well, it's not really a new stadium, is it? It's not. It's just like the old stadium. And they've got an extension done. That's basically it. It's not like they've gone to a new place and constructed an entirely new stadium. So, you know, let's call it what it is, a fixer-upper. But, you know, I wasn't aware. It wasn't as if all week long there were articles and videos and blog posts and tweets and Facebooks and all kinds of shite about, well, look at this new Tottenham Stadium. How does it compare to the Arsenal Stadium? Why can't it just be a fucking thing on its own? Because, like, A, nobody cares, apart from Tottenham fans, what the differences are between Arsenal Stadium and this, you know, refurb job that they did on White Hart Lane. Literally, nobody cares apart from Tottenham fans. So why don't they just, like, make it its own thing? It can just be a thing on its own. It doesn't have to be compared to everything else. It's like the bricks and mortar equivalent of combined 11. What's your combined Arsenal and Tottenham 11 ahead of a North London derby, which, of course, as we all know, that is a complete load of bollocks. Big old bollocky bollocks. Bollocking bollocky bastard bollocks. That's what I say about all that. It's going to be busy. It is going to be busy the next few weeks. We have a game on Sunday, and then we have a game on Thursday, and then we have a game on Monday, and then another game on Thursday, then a game on Sunday, then a game on Wednesday, then another Monday. And that is the month of April. All these fixtures piling up. No rest for the wicked. A lot for us to do. A big challenge between now and the end of April, because it will basically define our season. We've got two Premier League games in May, which of course are important, but you will have, and we will all have, a very good idea of whether or not top four is going to be a thing probably by the end of this month. The remaining Premier League games that we've got, Everton, of course, on Sunday, we're going to touch on that. Watford away on the Monday, then we've got Crystal Palace at home on the Sunday, Wolves away on Wednesday, and then Leicester away on the following Monday. So, given our away day inconsistencies, there's a lot going on in this particular month. And as I've said before, the games are going to come like Kyle Walker, thick and fast. So, as I said, we're going to talk about Everton in a moment with our first guest on the show today. A little bit later on, we're going to look at just a little bit further ahead, because it's not something myself and James normally do on the Arscast Extra, which is preview games that we've got coming up. But two games against Napoli in the Europa League are going to be a real test, a real challenge. What can we expect from Napoli? Who the danger men are? What way we should set up? All of that kind of stuff. We're going to talk to Paolo Bandini, because he, of course, knows everything there is to know about Serie A Italian football. So who better to talk to about Napoli than him? That's later, but right now, delighted to welcome back to the show a man many of you will know as the co-host of Men in Blazers. He is an Everton fan, and we're going to talk to him because Arsenal are playing Everton this weekend. It's Roger Bennett. Hi, Rog.
Oh, Andrew, it's great to be with you ahead of the weekend. Two teams with surging confidence. Arsenal's real. Everton's totally delusional. What could possibly go wrong?
Exactly. Well, look, I think between the two of us, what could possibly go wrong? It's limitless. There's no end of possibilities as to what could happen. Arsenal away from home, Everton being Everton, I guess. And we can talk about them a little bit later on. But you want to talk a little bit about what's happened at Arsenal this season under Unai Emery, and you've been pretty impressed with what you've seen.
I'm happy for you, Andrew. I'm happy for you. An Arsenal that's teetering with something other than self-loathing, it's a wonderful thing to see again. I mean, not quite self-confidence, and nowhere near self-love. But, I mean, I will say, at the beginning of the season, there was a danger that you were simply becoming posh Everton, but you have avoided that. And I feel a genuine delight for you. And also, I mean, it's the story that no one's talking about, possibly because of the Manchester City-Liverpool duel, possibly because of the romance of Solskjaer at United. But it's a transformation that no one is talking about, that everyone's sleeping on, the stealth storyline of the season, the Unai Emery revolution. He gets no respect, but he's done a ton right.
Yeah, I tell you, what's interesting, I think, is that so much of what revolved around Arsenal over the last couple of years was that, you know, Arsene Wenger was front and central to all of it because he'd been there for so long. And you know, the Wenger out thing was pervasive wherever you looked, whether it was at football or whether it was a political rally in Zimbabwe, there was somebody with a Wenger out sign. You know, Arsenal, much like some other things that are going on around the world that we don't need to mention, but everybody will know what we're talking about. They're inescapable back then. You know, when you turned on the news, there was Arsenal in much the same way that things are going on now. And I think that's gone. That kind of thing is gone now, and maybe we are flying a little bit under the radar because of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think mostly the most important radar that you're flying under right now, and it's the critical one, because you've got, you know, you've got a squad with glaring weaknesses playing to its strengths. You've got Laka, you've got his best mate, Aubameyang. Again, the two of them are a symbol of your Arsenal, probably the most slept-on strike duo in the Premier League right now. You've got, you know, this period of time that it's astounding. We emailed about it a bit this week, the week before together, where was it like 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago, English journalists were writing a lot of op-eds about Arsenal. What is the point of Arsenal? What, they've lost their complete mission. They're just drifting aimlessly. And you just tenaciously kept going. And ultimately, as an Everton fan, tenacity is one of the great joys that we've savoured in football, so I really admire it. You've got big games, you actually have hope in big games, a sense that Arsenal will now do something more than just roll over. But the one radar ultimately that's really important for you to actually know whether you're on it or not is Stan Kroenke's. Yeah. Actually, it's never clear to me, based in America, whether Stan Kroenke actually knows he owns Arsenal, Andrew, or whether he's just befuddled by a rounding error on his balance sheet and he gets occasionally, he's like, what is this, guys? What is this thing?
Well,
and
yeah,
ultimately, that's the critical thing for you guys as you look next step, whether he is willing to look at what Emery's done and say, there's something there. There's something really quite wonderful there for the first time in a long time, and I'm going to back it. I'm going to back it. He's not going to back it seriously because he's Stan bloody Kroenke. Who's going to back it sufficiently so you continue to grow?
Well, you hope so. I mean, I think this summer is going to be very interesting in that regard. He does have his hands and his wallet full with a project in Los Angeles to which he's given very significant financial guarantees. And, you know, Arsenal fans have been worrying a little bit about what kind of money we're going to have to spend this summer. But you would hope that if Emery does achieve what I guess he was brought in to achieve, and that's to bring back Champions League football to Arsenal, and we're in a good position to do that with 7 games left to play, albeit 5 of them are away from home, and you know, we have
they're winnable
on paper, they're winnable, but away from home, Arsenal have got this we've travel sickness. You know, no matter how much you try and keep the car steady or whatever, we need the, you know, to hang our heads out the window and be sick every so often. So that's kind of the worry that I have with where we are. We're in a great position, but you know, if we do achieve top four and get into the Champions League next season, I think people would be disappointed if there wasn't some measure of what's, as you say, backing from the owner of the club. Yeah. I mean, it's not that anybody, I don't think anybody expects Stan Kroenke to turn up in London and put down a briefcase full of gold bullion or cash or anything like that. But, you know, maybe expand the club's financial horizons a little bit and take a few risks in the transfer market.
He can give you one of his miniature giraffes that I think he keeps on his desk, or one of his Fabergé eggs. He'll cough one of those up. And ultimately, Emery definitely deserves that. I mean, for the past couple of seasons, we've always joked that to be an Arsenal fan was to, like, live out Nietzsche's words, that to live is to suffer and to survive is to find some meaning in the suffering. But I will say, as an Everton fan, I want, you know, ultimately, after saying that for the past four or five seasons, Arsenal fans can look at Everton and throw those words right back into my face. And I do encourage Arsenal fans, as you approach Everton, I know it's like you've travel sickness, there's all kinds of things, what can go wrong now? Everton are very much, we've ingrained ourselves as the equivalent of the Make-A-Wish Foundation, where when, you know, there's an awful reality and you need to have something great in your life, you come to clubs that haven't won in 12 games on the road, come to Goodison Park, and we're very, very generous. Clubs that desperately need 3 points because they're in the relegation zone. And everything, the thing you most yearn for most often happens when you interact with Everton. We're generous, we're charitable, we're very, very giving. It's been a dark season. Almost the opposite of yours, which, you know, ours started like a stock that traded strongly. I mean, I think of us like Theranos, we kind of spiked everywhere. Everyone was looking at us. And then December, Liverpool, Origi broke us with his shoulder. And we've really never recovered.
Yeah, that was a grim way to lose a derby, that's for sure. And look, much of what you're saying there about being very generous and hospitable to opposition teams, that will resonate with Arsenal fans, because that was certainly something that we were more than capable of, maybe still are capable of, but not as much under Emery. I know that when, you know, during the course of the season, you will come to the UK and you'll interview, and you've done interviews with lots of managers. You did a brilliant one with Arsene Wenger a couple of years ago. Are you planning or trying to do something with Unai Emery? Are you waiting maybe another 6 or 12 months until his English is a bit more fluent? At the moment, it's a little bit difficult to... for him, I think, to express himself as fully as he might, given that he's only a year into life in England and still learning the language. But I'd be really curious to see what you could get out of him.
Yeah, this year we did Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. It was really, genuinely a phenomenal bloke. We've just gone to Liverpool and spent the week with them and did we caught Jurgen Klopp at a wonderful time. Wonderful time for me. They'd just drawn with Everton. All the British journalists were at his throat, choking storylines and Salah storylines, and he just came in and I asked Jurgen Klopp. I was trying to ask him the same question, but not in the same way, because I'd just seen him be asked it 27 times by every British journalist, and it's like pushing on a nerve.
Yeah.
So I asked him. I said, Jurgen, how do you sleep when you're in the middle of a title race, trying to get in the same issues but a different way? And he goes, how do I sleep? He said, I sleep like any 51-year-old. I sleep for 2 or 3 hours at a time and then have to make a wee. And then he just died from there, exactly where I wanted to go. And he was really, really rather remarkable. I'd love to speak to Unai Emery. You say his English isn't good. It's definitely already better than mine. And I hope, I genuinely do that. The Premier League, I'm trying to watch football in this awful era, Andrew, this Trump era, this Brexit era, where there's just so much there is. I'm really trying, definitely the past 2 years, to watch football with so much less hate. And I'm a very horrible person. Anyone that knows me, I'm just an awful human being. But I'm trying to watch football without the hate and without, you know, there's enough of that in real life now to not spill it over. And I know it's a crazy idea from a British perspective, because football is a lot about feeling better about your team and laughing at everybody else's. But I look at Arsenal and... I'll be honest, everyone's better off when Arsenal are doing well. The Premier League's better off. The competition's better off. The whole of football is better off. And I'm genuinely thrilled for you. And I hope that if the finish is as strong as you want it to be, that I do get to spend some time with Arsenal that season. Because I mean, talking about hate, for much having said that, the only way to watch Everton this season, I've realised, is to actually hate watch them for long spells. You just hate watch them just to resign yourself to defeat before kickoff and enjoy whatever meagre scraps of pleasure can come your way. And that's kind of where I'm reserving the anger. I've got a huge amount of admiration. I loved it. What the Arsene Wenger interview I did, the quote that I love from it, and I think about it a lot, was he talked about the greatest quality he admires in footballers is tenacity. And you do better impressions than Arsene Wenger and all of your listeners do than I could do. So I'm not going to do his accent, but it sounds better from him. He did. He just said, at the end of the day, the greatest quality in a footballer, the greatest quality in life is tenacity, the willingness to get up off the floor when you're knocked down and keep going. And I really admire that greatly. And Arsenal have shown an incredible amount of tenacity. And I think it's a human wonder. Yep. Everton, no tenacity, none. And that's what pisses me off the most about this season.
So that's
really does.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's kind of where you are with Everton. You set the bar so low that any tiny little thing is jumped on and grasped as something to enjoy. Because, you know, when Sam Allardyce, who, you know, it's fair to say, never really came across to me as the kind of manager that Everton fans would warm to in terms of what they might envisage. Say,
how's Frey? Walder Frey, the Walder Frey of football. Just just a human darkness. Yeah, carry on.
But, you know, with Marco Silva coming in, it was supposed to be different, no? I mean, this was a young, up-and-coming manager, even if perhaps some alarm bells should have been ringing by the fact that, you know, when he goes to a club, he doesn't always stay there very long. But, you know, people were talking about, you know, his style of football. You know, he's young, he's Portuguese, he's maybe a bit charismatic. Comparisons were drawn with some other guy I can't remember at this point. He's, you know, gone out of the public consciousness and we can forget him. Because, you know, he's consigned to the dustbins of history. But, you know, was it not supposed to be different this season for Everton?
Yeah, I mean, football transformation projects are just like, they're ultimately like heart transplants. You never really know if the donor body is going to take to the new organ or not. You look at it, you know, you look at Klopp and what he's done at Liverpool, transforming that club. And when he came in, Liverpool fans, there's been moments where they've doubted completely. You know, always the stats they'll throw up. Brendan Rodgers at 42 games, Klopp at 42 games, same points. Mm. And you do that. You see Sarri, oh my Lord, coming in, meant to transform everything. You can pick several Chelsea managers, to be honest. And you look at, sometimes we all hail the new manager, the new transformation. Another reason why I love what Emery's done. I mean, to take those punches at the beginning with that brutal schedule that you had,
yeah,
and to just keep persistently, you never really know with transformation, unless it's at Everton Football Club, where it does have him one false start after another. You know, the Koeman false start, the Sam Allardyce, really a dark moment for anyone that cares about love. And how, I mean, we've lived a life, and I'm saying this to you. You've suffered. You've worn rusty nipple clamps for many 90-minute periods at a time. And we are sadder than the Tracy Chapman album. And almost the thing with Marco Silva is like we got to kind of keep him because otherwise it just becomes one false start after another. I mean, it's been a wasted season. And the only reason it could get worse, and I did have a nightmare to this effect, Andrew, recently, was that we hired Jose Mourinho in my dreams.
Oh.
And it was a human darkness. I watched the Oscars this is how desperate I am. I watched the Oscars this season. I watched the Oscars this year. And I was like, oh man, the Oscars did. It was all right with no host. It wasn't great, but it was all right. Maybe Everton should pioneer no management football, just play without a manager. Or get Tony Hibbert as player manager, which would be my best. Get Tony Hibbert back. Get him in there. Just managerless football may be the only way we can go. It's been a dark reality. It's been a wasted season. You know, Everton have, and you'll see on Sunday, we have a few partnerships on the field. We're always a team that overachieved. The Everton teams I've loved most, other than in the 80s, obviously, when we were a team of wonder. But the modern period was when we overachieved with hustle, with collective belief, you know, and combinations, Pienaar and Baines, Cahill versus all comers. And right now, we're just a team of parts. You don't really think of combinations. We're like an exquisite corpse of odd transfers, Panini sticker book driven transfers, you know, Gylfi, Sigurdsson, a wonderful man when he played with Llorente. That's such a funny combination. They were 150% players when they played together, and separate, they're like 33% of the of the men they were, both of them.
Yeah, and look, go on. One man I suppose we have to mention, I'm kind of loath to mention him because we have the...
Theon.
Yeah, Theon Gray, no joy. We have to mention him because, you know, as an Arsenal fan, and everyone listening to this is going to be worried that the former player thing comes back to bite us in the arse. And, you know, I'm sure somebody out there has done the stats where, in reality, a former player coming back to their old club only scores, you know, 6% of the time. But when you're an Arsenal fan, it feels like fucking 75% or 100% of the time. You know, Theo left, I think, with, you know, pretty much goodwill from the Arsenal fans because we felt like we had seen the best of him. But it hasn't gone particularly well at Everton. There's a story this week I read in The Guardian that his future is in doubt. He's not really playing very much anymore. I mean, what's your assessment of Theo Walcott going into this game?
Let me first of all assuage your fear about an ex-player haunting you at this weekend. There is more chance that Philippe Senderos will exhume himself from his grave and come back to Everton to haunt you. There's more chance that George Wood will come back and haunt you than Theo. Oh God! I mean, I look at. I mean, again, it's the Game of Thrones weekend. So, like, you look at Reek and the suffering he's been through, and I'd imagine like Theon has probably suffered less than poor Theo Walcott has at Everton. It's really heartbreaking from a human perspective, not a footballing one, to watch him, just watching a man, a lovely man, a good man, I think, playing in a puddle of his own bleeding confidence. He's got, I think, one goal since August. I'm not sure if that's August 2015, 2016. It was so bloody. He's had 30 minutes actually on the field since the Derby Day defeat that killed us. And there's a lot of players ahead of him. There's Bernard, tiny, weeny little toothpick of a player, Bernard. There's Richarlison with his little chicken head. Ademola Lookman, our giant baby, all ahead of him. And I look at Theon, and he's like a cautionary tale for all of you young listeners, kids listening to Andrew's show. If you don't find your confidence and your willingness to grind, you will get sent north above the wall. And he does. He acts as if Everton is the Night's Watch and he's been sent there for punishment for this night and all nights to come. And he just looks shell-shocked. He's still shell-shocked this long in, up north. I think of him like walking around the north of England, just terrified. He looks like a man who doesn't want to come out of his bedroom, and he just has his tattoo artist and the hairdresser come and do home visits. So I feel for him. And I think the game earlier in the season, my best mate is a huge Arsenal fan, lifetime gooner, Michael Cohen, not the awful dark Donald Trump one, another Michael Cohen. God love you, Michael Cohen. And we were watching the game together, and he just WhatsApped me. He goes, "We are both shit." Can I say that on your show?
Yes, of course.
You say that on television in America. You use that word all the time when you sit behind.
I didn't know. I would have been more creative if I'd known.
So Michael Kerrion, he goes, "Look, we're both shit. The only difference is you got Theo this time." So that's ultimately it. He will not come back to haunt you, Andrew, I can assure you.
Okay, I feel like you're protesting a little too much here, doing that thing. Like, there's no possible way that this could happen, you know. But
yes, that's definitely my style. I try and manage my expectations.
We'll see. But just before I let you go, just your thoughts on the Premier League season in general. I mean, it feels like there's a good title race going on. I know it's a little bit difficult for you because of your affiliation to Everton, but obviously, you know, Liverpool are potential champions for the first time in a long time. I have to say, personally, I'm glad that there's a title race, that it isn't just Manchester City and Abu Dhabi walking away with another Premier League. I know lots of the listeners would prefer Man City to win it because they're not going to be as inflicted by Manchester City fans as they are Liverpool fans, because they've got lots of Liverpool fans who they know, and Manchester City, not that they're a recent phenomenon, but their success at this level is, so people can sort of compartmentalize it a little bit more. But I think it's been quite an interesting season from that point of view. And then you look a little bit below what was a one team or three teams going for one place in the top four because of Tottenham's recent slump. Now we've got two teams or four teams going for two places. God, oh my, my maths is terrible today. But, you know, there is the title race, and then there's a good scrap for the other places in the top four, which makes it interesting for everyone, I think.
Yeah, but I can only speak about it from the American perspective is probably most useful, because the questions you're outlining, each one of your listeners, everyone in a pub anywhere in Europe will weigh in with their opinions, and almost everyone will agree with you. I can say from America, where the game has really taken off since the 2010 World Cup, and then really the 2014, it went mainstream with the Premier League. You know, Americans love the best, the NFL is there, that is Super Bowl, it's the best, it is the best in the world. They're World Series baseball, which is a monopoly, it's always two North American teams, but it is the best baseball teams in the world. And it's quite perplexing for them. You know, the NBA, the best basketball, the best football is not in America, and it is in it is in England. And so they watch this Premier League, and they love it also because it's not competing in prime time against their other sports. They can get up, open a beer at breakfast. Americans love daytime drinking, and any excuse for that is a double win. So they've really gotten into this Premier League. I can say there's been an incredible spike. You know, the league's been growing for the under 30 demo, which is the coveted one in television land, massively year to year. But this year it's been, the growth has been unbelievable because of the narrative, the race for the title, the race for the top four, even just the fact that people, everybody else, is sucked into the mire of that last relegation place. It's like the soap opera, the telenovela worth of narrative is really gripping. This weekend, last weekend, NBC, or the rights holder here, had a had a live broadcast from Fenway Park, obviously the Liverpool connection, owned by the Liverpool owners.
Yeah.
And they had 11,000 fans come and watch the games outside of Fenway. It was an amazing scene. It was an even I'm a cynical, horrible, awful human being. I looked at it, I was like, oh my God, there's 11,000 people watching outside together, watching Liverpool and Tottenham. And I can just say it's really, there's an incredible spike, and Americans are genuinely remarkably hooked. And and for your benefit of your audience, Arsenal have a huge, huge percentage. They really outpunch their weight as Americans are looking at the Premier League with fresh eyes, ungeographically moored. They're trying to find the team that they support. American Arsenal fans is an incredibly incredibly fast-growing demographic, and you will no doubt have a great weekend against a team, Everton, whose season highlight thus far has been booing Ross Barkley against Chelsea, having a cat run onto the field, a beautiful little black cat with stunning green eyes, and watching Jordan Pickford with his smallest little windmills you'll ever see getting into a bar fight. That is essentially the entirety of our season highlight DVD. So I expect you're going to have a great weekend ahead, Andrew.
Okay, well, I do. I know we have a very big American audience who will be listening to this, of course. And, you know, a cat on the pitch is right up there with a dog in a school, isn't it? It's one of the greatest things that can ever happen. Look, there's a dog in the school. How did it get in here? It's brilliant. Well, look, I hope we get a dog and a cat on the pitch on Sunday, and hopefully hopefully it's a good game. Rog, it's a pleasure as always to talk to you. Arsenal are in the US, of course, this summer. They're playing in LA. They're playing in Charlotte in North Carolina, and also just outside Washington, D.C. So maybe we might get to see you at some point during the summer.
Oh, mate, I'd love to have a pint with you. What's your prediction? Let's finish with a prediction for you for the weekend.
I'm hopeful we might just sneak it 3-2, because I, you know, I worry a bit about us defensively. We've kept three clean sheets in a row, so I feel like we're saving something up from a defensive lapse point of view. But we do have some good goal scorers in the team, so hopefully we can nick it by a single goal. You?
My heart says 5-0 Everton, Cenk Tosun with all five goals. But my mind looks at last season's games. You won 5-2, didn't you? When we scored first in that one. And then you won 5-1. Aaron Ramsey always seems to do it. So this befuddling farewell talk that he's on, I don't understand it. You probably have talked hours about it. Yeah. I have a feeling you're absolutely... I think we're going to score first. You're going to absolutely lather us. I even see Mustafi getting a goal and I'll end up in a heap in a recovery position, having a sad nap. There'll be lots of fast car. Enjoy every second and courage to all of your listeners. Thanks, man.
You won't be alone if Mustafi scores. I think there'll be a lot of people in the fetal position trying to figure out what the fuck has happened. Raj, thanks a million.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you very much indeed to Raj. You can find him on Twitter at Raj Bennett, at Raj Bennett. If you're in the US, you can watch him as one half of Men in Blazers on a little-known network called NBC. You can download the Men in Blazers podcast if you like. And I absolutely think he was playing down the potential for Theo Walcott to make an impact in this game, just so he might make Theo Walcott have an impact in that way that we wear lucky socks and think that might make a difference when we go to a football match. It doesn't. But there you go. Also, I didn't rise to the Tracy Chapman bait, did I? No, I didn't. We can do that another day, I think.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Right, it's time to look ahead a little bit further than this weekend, because we have got two Europa League ties against Napoli coming up, and who better to take us through the ins and outs of that than Paolo Bandini. Hi, Paolo.
Good to be on, as always.
Tell me this about our Europa League opponents. They are second in Serie A. Juventus obviously are running away with it. But Napoli, they've a 7-point gap over Inter Milan in third place. They are, would you say, by some way the best of the rest?
Yes, they certainly have been. And it's sort of interesting at the moment because they go through this slightly erratic run of form in which, you know, even in the last, 5 days, they thumped Roma 4-1. Now, admittedly, Roma are a bit of a mess at the moment, but Roma are theoretically one of the teams vying for a Champions League spot right now, a team that was in the Champions League this season. And they beat them 4-1 on their own patch. And they've gone and lost just last night to Empoli, who are relegation strugglers away from home. And they're a team slightly struggling for motivation at the moment because they've been so comfortably second for a long time. And the gap to Juventus now at the top of this double tick, it's 18 points. I knew it was so many points that you don't even keep track anymore. And it's been like that forever. You know, Juventus got ahead early and haven't looked back, which is a very different position, for instance, to the one that Napoli were in last season, when Napoli were pushing them right till the end, when they did get over 90 points themselves, when they were really sort of believing at a certain point in April that actually they could win the title. So their whole season is distilled down to these two Europa League games now. It's as simple as that. I mean, after the defeat to Empoli, Carlo Ancelotti, obviously their manager, was talking about a lack of motivation and focus from his players, and he tried to insist that it wasn't about the Europa League, but it's hard to colour it any other way. It's what they've got to play for this season, given that their top four spot is effectively assured. So it's very much all they're focused on right now is the Arsenal tie, whereas of course Arsenal have a few other things to worry about at the same time.
Arsenal have two irons in the fire, I think, when it comes to the Champions League, because the Premier League, something we might talk about a bit later, is a consideration for Arsenal. So what you're saying basically is that we are going to face a Napoli side that, even if they are somewhat struggling for motivation in Serie A, are going to be laser focused on these two Europa League games, because that is the competition that can give them something tangible from this season.
Yeah, I mean, this was, I was actually just doing an Italian football podcast earlier today for ESPN, and I was having this exact conversation about Napoli. I was saying, it's fine, they can lose to Empoli and it doesn't matter, because the gap to fifth place, I think, is 15 points. So it's 18 points to first and it's 15 points to fifth. There's nothing to worry about. But it's that same question we end up asking of teams like Paris Saint-Germain, say, in Europe, and when they sort of are steamrolling everyone, and we say, okay, but are they playing competitive games? Are they going to get late in the European competition and not know how to play a competitive game anymore? And I suppose that's the concern from Napoli's point of view, is are they going to be able to switch the gears back up and say, oh, hang on, this is the one that matters? But certainly they can sort of conserve their energies for it because, yes, as you just said, they've only got the one iron in the fire.
Has this season domestically been a disappointment for them then, given how much more competitive the league was last season? Was there belief that they could push Juventus all the way? I mean, you know, this will be what, Juventus' seventh or eighth consecutive Serie A title?
This will be the eighth.
So
And it's, you know, it's easy to look at that and just assume they've all been walkovers, when, as I've just said, last season definitely wasn't. I mean, when Napoli went to Turin and beat Juventus in April, it very much looked like the ball was in their court. Juventus had much tougher remaining fixtures, but Napoli just couldn't quite last the course. They still, again, got over 90 points. So it was an extraordinary season. And the thing for Napoli is, whilst, of course, fans would much rather see them competing with Juventus, having the season they had last year, there's also a very strong awareness in Naples that that isn't a realistic expectation. In terms of finances, they're not only a long way behind Juventus. Napoli don't spend anything like, say, Inter do or Milan do, or I think even than Roma do. They're not sort of structurally one of the richest clubs in Italy. They're not one of those clubs that has the international brand that generates all this extra income. They're a club that represents an extremely passionate and wholehearted city, in which they have incredibly committed and loud support, but they have an absolutely disgraceful stadium, which is why, even though they've got that great support, you often see the stadium not being full, because it's somewhere between sort of just dilapidated and horrible to be in, and also unsafe in parts. It's just a really bad stadium. And so, yes, they're a club that has been punching above its punching above its weight in recent years, really, to be Juventus' number one challenger. They're not structurally that. And it's why the Europa League, whilst it was disappointing for them to crash out of the Champions League, I mean, bear in mind, they started the season so well in the Champions League, it really looked like they were going to be getting out of that group, which they shared with Paris Saint-Germain and Liverpool. And they got pipped right at the last by Liverpool as well. So it was a disappointment for them to come into the Europa League, but the Europa League is very much something that would mean a lot there and would be a significant trophy, because they're not a team, again, structurally built to do this. They had their golden era with Diego Maradona, but they're not a team that has won trophies consistently in any way through their history. So it's not disappointment that they're not close to Juventus. It's definitely been a year of transition, because obviously Maurizio Sarri was there last year, and now as everyone at Chelsea has discovered, Maurizio Sarri is a very particular coach. He comes in and it's his way, and he has... Look, it worked for Napoli. It was fantastic for Napoli. Again, 91 points. He was a huge success there. But it's a very ideological way of viewing football, Maurizio Sarri. There's a system, and the system is king. Ancelotti is the opposite. Ancelotti is a pragmatist and someone who has a more laid-back way of sort of certainly at least being in public, and who definitely has a more flexible approach when it comes to tactics and to how he sort of approaches games. I think that, well, again, you know, talking just in terms of results, they've been worse. So from that point of view, you could argue that there could be some disappointment, but my sense has not been at all... from the people I speak to in Naples, that anyone is disappointed by what happened, by the results in the league this season, because again, the expectation bar isn't set so high in Naples, even after what happened last season. And there's been a lot of enjoyment, actually, of the football that's been played under Ancelotti, the fact that he's rotated in a bunch of younger players who Maurizio Sarri didn't use. He's been more flexible in his approach. And he's just such a genial character, Ancelotti. I mean, he's a hard guy not to like, that he's won a lot of support in Naples. But of course, they would really love to go all the way in this competition.
Sure, and they've had, you know, David Ospina to give them some of the lols as well along the way.
But yeah, well, you know, he also, I mean, I'm sure you would have seen this, that, you know, he was caught in a not so jolly situation the other day, where he took a serious blow to the head, happily all okay in that situation in the end. He isn't and never has been by design their number one goalkeeper, but he has ended up sort of functioning as it a lot this season, because Alex Meret, who's the young Italian who's supposed to be the future of that position, he's been injured a lot. So Ospina's actually played a good number of games, and he's done pretty well. He's done okay. Meret is back and should be playing against Arsenal.
So, I mean, when you talk about Ancelotti in terms of tactical flexibility, are we looking at a coach who operates in a similar kind of way to Unai Emery, in that he will tailor his approach to the opposition? What way has he got Napoli playing this season?
Yeah, so most games under Ancelotti, we've seen a 4-4-2 of some description, but it is 4-4-2. Sometimes it feels like that's a sort of notional starting point, and then it can be very flexible. For instance, in those Champions League games at the beginning of the season, when he was doing very well against Liverpool, obviously beat Liverpool in Naples, drew away to Paris Saint-Germain, was really unlucky to draw that game, because it took a wonder goal from Angel Di Maria late in the game to level that up, and then they drew again against Paris Saint-Germain at home. What we saw in those games actually was that the formation, while again it was notionally a 4-4-2, he was starting Nikola Maksimovic, who is very much I suppose he has played it right back in his career, but he's not fast, and he's someone who you look at and think, really, you want him at right back? And that's notionally where he was in this 4-4-2. Now, in reality, every time Napoli were losing the ball, Maksimovic was sliding inside, and Callejon was dropping back to play as a wing back. So it became a 3-5-2 much more. And Maksimovic at right back was sort of a constant feature during that Champions League run. I think at the beginning, people looked at it and thought, this guy's absolutely bonkers, because he's lining him up against guys like Sadio Mane. He's lining him up against Kylian Mbappe, these incredibly fast attackers, and Maksimovic is really slow. But again, because the formation was fluid, it didn't work out like that. You were never leaving Maksimovic isolated against one of those attackers. And if anything, perhaps you were lulling opponents into thinking that was a way to attack you, when actually it wasn't. So it's often in that sort of subtlety with Ancelotti that you see his I guess his genius. I mean, we can call him that. He's won the Champions League several times. So those are the things that have stood out about his Napoli team. In terms of the broad structure, it has generally been a two-man attack, which is different, of course, to Maurizio Sarri, who generally plays with a three-man attack. At the beginning of the season, the sort of the great revelation was Lorenzo Insigne, who's always been playing out wide under Sarri, coming inside and really having an electric start to the campaign there in a number 10 role, and looked like he could take his career up to another level there. Recently, he hasn't been in great form, Insigne, which has been perhaps one of the reasons why Napoli's results are a bit more up and down.
He's injured too, isn't he?
Sorry?
He's injured too, isn't he, at the moment? Or
yes, he is, yeah. So we're not going to, I don't think, see him certainly in the first leg. And in any case, it's not really the first-choice attack for Napoli anymore. The first-choice attack for Napoli now would be led by Arek Milik, the Polish striker, who's much more conventional. He's a big, tall, powerful centre-forward, good in the air, but not as quick. And so that's what Arsenal will be up against, I think. And I don't expect to see any sort of particular wrinkles in that. It'll be a two-man attack, and it'll most likely be Mertens and Milik.
What about defensively? Because in Serie A, anyway, I think they've probably the second or best, or second or third best defensive record in the league. They've only conceded 26 goals. So, you know, are there challenges there for this Arsenal attack? Because if there is a strength in this Arsenal team, of course it is going forward with Aubameyang and Lacazette, Mkhitaryan, Iwobi, Ozil, Ramsey, these guys who can really cause defences problems. Will they be worried about what Arsenal, the threat that Arsenal can pose?
Any sensible manager will be worried about what Arsenal have up front at the moment. Obviously, Aubameyang and Lacazette in particular, last Monday night, just looking absolutely fantastic at the moment. So I'm certain he'll be concerned about it. What they have got, Napoli, is, in my opinion, one of the absolute best centre-backs in the world right now in Kalidou Koulibaly. The area in which I would say they are potentially more vulnerable is down the flanks at fullback. Now, of course, as I just mentioned, it'll be interesting to see exactly which formation we get out of Ancelotti. Even if it is again notionally a 4-4-2, are we going to get Maximovic back there at fullback and that back three in effect, and having the two or having Callejon particularly on the right drop back and do more defensive work? Because if it's if it's not that, I'm actually just sorry. I'm stalling slightly. I'm just checking something on the injury news.
Sure.
Even as I speak to you, yeah. So yes, I think looking at who he's got available, it's most likely going to be Hussai at right back and Mario Rui at left back. Mario Rui is not a good left back. Mario Rui is slow. He's I think the accepted term in the modern football parlance is he's a shithouse. And he will get exposed if you attack him with pace. I think that's definitely an area in which I would consider Napoli to have some vulnerability. The question is, you know, what necessarily are you going to do with that? Again, I wouldn't necessarily think that putting balls into the box is particularly smart against this Napoli defence if we're going for crosses into middle, because Koulibaly is so authoritative in the box, because they have got some strength at centre-back.
Yeah.
I think that Raul Albiol very possibly is not going to make it back for either of these two legs. He's been out since early February, so I'm not certain he'll be there, which does mean that Koulibaly's partner is slightly less certain. You've had Luperto playing there recently, who's a bit more inexperienced. It could be Maximovic who slides in there, which takes away your option of going with a back three, perhaps. But yeah, they're solid at the back, Napoli. They're certainly not bad there, but I don't think it's for instance, like going up against this Juventus team, you might look at and think, wow, that's a really sort of imposing defence with Chiellini, with Bonucci. It's a good defence, but it's not impenetrable.
Right. And, you know, given that Arsenal are at home in the first leg, what way do you expect Napoli to approach this game? Because an away goal could be very, very important. The onus will be on Arsenal at home to come out and win the game. If there is a vulnerability, there are a number of vulnerabilities around Arsenal, which, despite recent results, you know, they're not too far beneath the surface. Being hit on the counter-attack is one of those, as we are pushing up the other end. Are they a team that are effective in that regard? Is that something that we have to worry about a great deal, or are there strengths, their attacking strengths, do they lie elsewhere?
Well, no, I mean, they definitely can be effective on the counter. Again, it depends slightly which attack we see. If it's Mertens and Milik, then you've kind of got a very sort of, I don't know, you've got a very nice combination of different skill sets there. Mertens obviously is quick. He's good with the ball on his feet. He's good on the ground. And he's someone who you can use to really stretch the field if you're looking to counterattack. And I'm certain he'll be used that way. At the same time, Milik is very effective in the air, very good for knocking the ball up to and having him hold the ball up. That's something that he can do very effectively for you. And of course, the two of them can play off each other like that, because Milik's good for the knockdown, good for getting out of defence with a high ball and knocking it down for Mertens on the run. So they have options for breaking out if they're going to play on the back foot, and I think it's reasonable to expect, given Arsenal's home form in general, that they will be playing on the back foot whether they want to or not in North London. I do think that I do think that Ancelotti's not a manager to sit back and entirely wait for you. I think if we look at the way they played, again, above all, again, away to PSG in the Champions League group stages, they actually played with a lot of moxie. They were very willing to try and dictate the game when they thought they had opportunities to. They've got a real, I'm trying to think of the right language to describe them. They've got a ball player in Zielinski in midfield. They've got someone who can dictate the tempo, who can sort of look up around him and control the game if he has the opportunity to do that. They've got a really powerful ball winner alongside him in Alan. They've got the tools to try and run the game a little bit as well. And I think that it would be uncharacteristic for them not to at least try. But I do think away from home against Arsenal, there's going to be a recognition as well. It's going to be very hard for them to dominate possession, for instance. It's going to be very hard for them to dominate the field. So it'll be a question of being opportunistic as well.
Be interesting to see what Arsenal do in central midfield. You know, when you talk about players who can dictate the playing there, someone who can disrupt, and Lucas Torreira is somebody who is sidelined at the moment from a domestic point of view because of suspension, but obviously will know Napoli well from his time in Serie A with Sampdoria. It seems likely to me, given he's got fresh legs and that experience, that he's a guy who could, who Unai Emery could use to make the difference in there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, I'm a big fan of Lucas Torreira. I've enjoyed watching him this season, and I think he would be certainly a solid choice in this game. It's interesting because, yes, as I say, Alan is a physical player. Alan is going to try and dominate those midfield battles one way or another, and that's very much his role in that midfield, to be physical, to be imposing. And I think in terms of just his structure, you can imagine him winning that fight. I mean, he's not tall himself, by the way, but he's muscular, winning that fight with Torreira on a physical basis. But it's not always just physicality that wins the day, is it? There's more to being a clever midfield destroyer than that. And I think that I think it'll be a fascinating battle, to be honest, between them and Torreira, both on the pitch.
All right, we'll look forward to that. I just wanted to ask you something about Monchi. You talked about Roma not being in a great position, and Monchi was, as far as we know, like a fair way down the road of becoming the technical director at Arsenal. Before going back to his former club, Sevilla, sort of at the last minute, where there was an expectation at the Emirates that Monchi was going to arrive. Based on the work he's done there in Rome and in Italy, and some of the comments made by the Roma owner, maybe, I don't want to put you on the spot or anything, but perhaps a bit of a bullet dodged.
I think a lot of Roma fans hold Monchi up as the sort of maybe alongside the owner Jim Pilotta, I think he's sort of held up as the architect of things that have gone wrong there. I think that the transfer approach that the club led this summer was undoubtedly something. I mean, you know, I wrote about it at the time, so I'm not being wise after the fact on this. It was a very questionable strategy for me. In the look, a lot of interesting young talent brought in, which is, of course, an intelligent thing to do if you're a club like Roma that know you have to sell as well to sell as well as buy to be sustainable. You have to be able to make profits on certain players. Some of those have looked extremely promising. I mean, Nicolò Zaniolo, who came in the exchange with Roger Nainggolan going the other way, has been brilliant. You could look at Justin Kluivert and say he's shown some flashes of real promise. You could go back to last season and say Cem Cezunda, someone who's flashed incredibly sort of game-changing talent, although he's also been very inconsistent. But these are judgments that, for the most part, you can't rush. These young players, you've got to give them time to develop. In the meantime, though, he's dropped significant money on a couple of older players who haven't panned out at all. I mean, Javier Pastore for about 30 million euros is an utterly sort of bizarre signing. You had a manager, Eusebio Di Francesco, until recently when he was fired, who is very much a fan of the 4-3-3, thinks that's the best system in football, has been on the record in all sorts of interviews saying as much. So it's no secret that's the way he likes to play. And Monchi buys a player who is really only effective in the number 10 role and has been, as a result, a total waste. Stephen Nzonzi, who has been linked to Arsenal in his time as well,
sure,
a talented player But again, not a young player, getting on for 30 at the time he was signed, and very much similar in mould to Daniele De Rossi, who you already have. Fine, you could talk about looking for an heir to De Rossi, although if you're looking for that, I would question why you're not going a little bit younger. And in the meantime, you let Nainggolan go and you let Strootman go in the same summer, both of whom are sort of combative midfielders and also leaders in the changing room to a great extent. You sign a whole wealth of interesting, talented young midfielders, but who all do basically exactly the same job, players who are best sort of breaking the lines, bringing it forward from midfield into attack and getting up to support the attack, and just create no balance in that midfield at all. So you've been left all season with De Rossi either on his own at 36 years old now, trying to wage a one-man war in front of the defence, which he hasn't got the legs for, or Nzonzi coming into replacement. Nzonzi's a good sort of deep-line midfielder and distributor. He's not really a destroyer either, so there's just no substance to that midfield. And I think for that, you have to blame Monchi. It's a very long-winded answer. Sorry, because a lot of Arsenal fans won't necessarily care about the specifics, but that's just to highlight a way in which Monchi, whilst he might have identified some interesting talent that could be good for Roma in the future, just didn't seem to build a team. He didn't seem to build something that was coherent. And certainly the line out of Jim Pilotta, the owner, is, look, you were in charge, buddy. You know, I sort of spoke, you know, hired you and gave you this responsibility and listened to you because you were the football guy. You know, I'm an American sports owner and I'm being guided by my football people. I'm being guided by the people who tell me what's right, and that was your job. And I think that Monchi was given a lot of room to maneuver at Roma. I think he was given a lot of trust, and I don't think in 2 years that they felt like they really got that much great out of him. So look, I think with managers and directors, context matters. Sometimes being in the right place at the right time and the right opportunities can change things. Of course, Roma had one really big letdown in the transfer market, which they were so close to signing Malcolm. The deal was basically done. Then suddenly he goes and joins Barcelona instead. And who knows? Maybe if he comes, everything is right in the world and they have a fantastic season. But I look at that transfer strategy that he led, especially last summer. I look at the fact that they don't have any competent centre-back pairing, really. I said competence, taking it too far. I'm overstating
it. I know what you mean.
They don't have an adequate, I would say, centre-back partner for Kostas Manolas. They don't have an adequate alternative to Edin Dzeko up front, because Patrick Schick has been there not delivering on his potential for too long now. And yeah, I think Monchi could have done better, put it that way.
Okay. Right, well, we'll see what Arsenal do.
Sorry, I feel like I maybe unburdened a bit on Monchi there.
You know, no, that's fine. That's fine. It was just sort of wind you up and let you go on that one. Yes. You felt like you needed to get that off your chest a little bit, so I'm happy to give you the platform to do that. And we'll see what Arsenal do. Just a couple of quick ones before we go. You know, Arsenal are in fourth, down from third earlier in the week, but when you consider the gap between Spurs and Arsenal 5 or 6 weeks ago, you know, it's promising, and we're in a promising position to secure top four. Are we sort of where you thought we might be at this point in the season, or are maybe a little bit ahead of where you thought we might be?
Yeah, I'd probably ever so slightly ahead. I'll be honest, Andrew, I think for a long time I didn't dare to think that we could be in the top four this late in the season with a game in hand on Tottenham that could put us up in third in theory. And I'm very much in the camp that is counselling caution at the moment, because I think there's a lot of people looking at that league table and looking at the just the names of the teams Arsenal have left to face and thinking that Arsenal are a very good bet. And I think that as it was highlighted on the blogs, I think that the away form and the fact that 5 of those 7 games are away from home is getting a little bit overlooked at the moment. I think there's a possible explanation for us being a little further ahead than I thought, and that's that we've played more of our home games than we have our away games, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And as many people have said, I don't have a great explanation for why it has been so different at home and away. It's not that the Emirates is a cauldron necessarily all the time, and that we are a scary place for people to come from an atmosphere point of view. But yeah, I'm sure part of that is all just me trying not to jinx us as well. I very much want to feel optimistic, but I'm a bit scared at the moment. It's an awareness that my hope levels have climbed that's making it scary.
Yeah, because it's kind of easy when you go, there's no chance. You know, you can live with that quite easily. It's what might be and what could be, I guess. But I suppose I think what gives me a little bit of hope is that, a little bit of hope, I mean, I say that when you look at the fixtures, I know they're away and I know we have our problems away. But I've kind of liked Emery's problem solving throughout this season. He has had problems to solve. You know, we had that long unbeaten run at the start of the season after we lost our first two games, and there were issues in that, and we all know what they were defensively. But, you know, he's had a situation with Mesut Ozil to deal with, and we seem to have a nice kind of effective truce, if you like to call it that, at this moment in time, which has seen Ozil come back in the team and do well. Ramsey's future, now that it's sorted, has provided either clarity or freedom to him. We had issues with injuries. You know, we've had to cope with Hector Bellerin, Rob Holding, Danny Welbeck. We've done more or less that. We had a bad run. We came out of that. And I think that is kind of what gives me a bit more hope, because the away form is a problem. And it's something to which he needs to find a solution. And based on what we've seen so far, I feel more confident. I'm not saying he's definitely going to do it, but I do feel more confident about his ability to do it now than I did 6 weeks ago or 8 weeks ago.
Yeah, and you touched on something there, which I think is really important. Look, it's not a secret to anyone. It's sort of been measured statistically and talked about at length that playing in the Europa League tends to disadvantage teams in the league. It tends to the Thursday-Sunday schedule, whatever you think of that, whatever you sort of want to hypothesize about. I hear this sometimes, people saying, oh, they're professional footballers, they earn a lot, they should be able to handle it. It doesn't matter, you know, what you would like to be true. The fact is that in general, we can sort of see a statistical link between doing that and results suffering for it. And I think that, therefore, when you know that to be true, one of the most important things you can have available to you late in the season when you're doing that schedule is, I guess, as big a squad as you can have, as ample a squad of players you can have. And I think that two players you just mentioned, Ozil and Ramsey, who at different times have had a real sort of difficulties in their relationship, clearly with the club and perhaps with the manager as well, they're very much in the fold at the moment, aren't they? And Ramsey, I think everyone's having this sort of nostalgic moment where it's sad by the thought that he's going, because he's played so well in the last few games. But Meza as well has been part of this, has been involved. And I think that is one of the things that's impressed me most about Emery, is that I suppose there was a certain point, especially with Ozil, where you looked at him and thought, God, is this like his, his I don't know, his pet project, but more like, you know, his pet peeve is Mesut Ozil or something, and he's never going to be able to reconcile it, and he's decided he's going to sort of burn this player almost on a point of principle.
Yeah.
And it's been the opposite. It's been a willingness to draw a line under things at the right time, to be flexible and make the opportunity for people to come back and impress you and do something for you. And I think that's critical at this point of the season, when we really need all hands on deck.
Do you think perhaps we underestimate the time it takes for a manager to get to know his players and his squad? And, you know, when you add in with Emery as well, a new country, a new league, a new style of football, it's not as if English football is completely alien to him. You know, he's had experience of it through his European experiences with his previous clubs. But yeah, I thought it was quite interesting the other week where he said something along the lines, I'm paraphrasing, where, you know, he understands what Ramsey and Ozil can give him in terms of tactical flexibility now. And maybe it's sort of coming to the party a bit late, but it must take time for any manager and any new coach to really understand. You know, you look at Mesut Ozil, yes, I've got a brilliant playmaker, but, you know, if you read what Arsene Wenger has said about him, if you read even what Jose Mourinho has said about him in the past, he is a player who requires a certain dexterity in terms of man management, right? Mm-hmm. And that will be true not just of Ozil, but it'll be true of many players. How do you get the best out of them? How do you, you know, how do you find the right combinations? It could be a case that he's finding those things or has discovered those things over the course of the season and now is in a better position to put all the pieces together to make something effective.
Of course, you know, every manager's job when they come into a new one, whether it's a new country or the same country, there's always going to be a bit of trial and error at the beginning, unless you're doing exactly what your predecessor did, and that carries its own risks. If you're going to do that, you can sort of end up in a situation where you feel like you're just creating a slightly less good replica. I hate to make everyone look across London, but I mean, you could draw a really recent example of that in Antonio Conte's first season at Chelsea, where a few games in, it looked like it was going to be a total catastrophe. He worked his formation on and went on to win the league. So, of course, there's scope within a season to work things out tactically and also in terms of personality of your players and who can give you something and who can give you something else and the nuances of everyone's game. I think that's 100% natural. I think it's probably also natural that players, that works both ways. Players take some time to get used to a new manager and his regime, and some might not. Some might sort of get there on day one and be like, oh my goodness, this is the guy I've been waiting for. This guy looks at football like I do, and I get it. Like, I understand that right away, and I can jump straight in. But there might be other players who need a while to understand a perspective, to sort of go, okay, you know what, I didn't get this at first, what you're trying to do with this team, but having done 100 repetitions of this now in practice, I understand it and I see why it works.
Yeah.
I think of course there's so much sort of more subtle going on than you get in the headlines and the obvious sort of well, not even the obvious, even just in sort of putting in terms of the glimpse that we ultimately get of what happens between a manager and a player. We see the 90 minutes every Thursday, Sunday. They get day-to-day contact, day-to-day relations, day-to-day sort of very specific high-level work done on the training ground, because that's their job. And perhaps, if anything, it's the most encouraging sign you would want to see from a manager is that he's doing his job better the longer he's there, because that means those relationships are strengthening and people are understanding more what they want from each other.
Mm. Well, look, maybe it's all coming together at the right time. And if it helps in those five away games we've got from the seven Premier League games we've got remaining, then all the better. We better leave it there. I appreciate the time, as always, Paolo. Thanks very much.
Anytime.
Cheers to Paolo. You can find him on Twitter @Paolo_Bandini. Napoli are going to be a hell of a test, but it's good. I'm looking forward to it, I have to say. I'm looking forward to big European nights against quality opposition. Bate Borisov, Ren. I'm not necessarily putting them in the same category, but, they don't get the juices flowing in any way, do they? Really? Come on. Nobody's that excited about playing those kind of teams. So, que sera, sera in the Europa League. If we go through, good. If we don't, maybe it will be just the thing that we need to consolidate our place in the top four. Could be a case, though, that depending on what happens in April, that the Europa League grows in importance. This is why this month is just so so crucial to where this season is going to go and what next season is going to be like. We do have Everton on Sunday. I guess there are going to be some team issues. Granit Xhaka and Laurent Koscielny missed the game against Newcastle on Monday night. We don't have any info as of yet about their potential availability coming up for Sunday. Aaron Ramsey came off on Monday night against Newcastle. Unai Emery said it was cramp. So if it was just cramp, then you would assume he's going to be ready and he'll be available to play. Lucas Torreira still suspended. And beyond that, I don't think we've got any problems unless some crop up tomorrow when the press conference happens. As for the game itself and what's coming up, Emery this week made a very clear point about how the team need to try and replicate their home form, which is fantastic. 44 points at home this season, which is, it's up there with what Manchester City and Liverpool have done this season, and they're two teams that are fighting for the title. Away from home, we've only got 19 points, and that's very, very mid-table. So he's looking for this team to produce what they can produce at home away. And I don't think there's any reason from a footballing point of view why they can't do it. There's got to be something else. It's a confidence thing. It's a psychological thing. We're slightly better this season than we were last season, but the bar is very low there because we were just so bad last season. If we can put together a run of games towards the end of this campaign where we can do it on the road, then it's going to make our chances of finishing in the top four all the better. So we'll keep fingers crossed for that. And I don't know what else to say about Sunday's game. We can beat Everton, we know that. But the away day thing looms large. It's a bit of a weight on our shoulders. So let's hope the team are up for it and focused and ready to go. So that's it. That's it for this podcast. Thank you, as ever, for listening. Really do appreciate it. James and I will be recording an Arscast Extra. Of course, it may well be a case that the podcast this weekend comes out on Sunday. We could be recording Sunday evening due to, it doesn't matter why, but we could be. So the podcast could be available on Sunday night, not long after the game. Well, actually, a bit after the game, because it's probably going to take a couple of hours for us to sit down and do it, a couple of hours to record and edit and publish it and all that kind of stuff. But it could well be out on Sunday evening, if not first thing Monday morning. So join us for that. We'll have Arsblog and Arsblog news across the weekend. So until the next one, take it easy, folks. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Now, as we continue our tour of the new White Hart Lane, we come to the bar, the longest bar in any football club in the Premier League. It's 76 metres long, and it's estimated you'll only ever have to wait 12 or 13 minutes to get a pint from our on-site craft brewery, which of course has got its own IPA. IPA, what does it stand for? Idiots prefer Arsenal. Oh, I do love making that joke. Now, to another feature that not too many people are aware of, and this is one of the most fantastic new things about this stadium, is our generator room. What's so special about a generator room, I hear you say? Well, not only does it keep things going when there's a power cut in the general area, the engineers have done something remarkable. That's right. When the generators are running, they sound exactly like Harry Kane. I promise you, it's incredible. Let me open the door and give you a listen. Truly amazing. But now for the most important part of our tour, the trophy room. Let me bring you inside. Another remarkable bit of engineering here is the echo inside this trophy room. When you say something, it takes exactly 19.61 seconds to reverberate back to commemorate the last time we won the league in 1961. Let me demonstrate. Hello?
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.